Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. We are, as always, joined by our super producer. Oh, gosh, it's hard to think of a nickname for Noel today because we're looking at a really rich story with a lot of references.
A lot of references. So, man, I don't know. Should we even attempt right now to give him a nickname? Or you know, here's what happens. Usually we say we're going to think about it during the show.
Well,
sometimes we do and sometimes we don't, you know? Yeah. So maybe we should. How about Case? On the Case.
On the Case.
On the Case.
Yeah.
That'll tie in somehow.
We'll run into that.
Hey, but how about Noel the Refrigerator Brown?
I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking, like, the fridge. Because that's a cool name. Or the cooler. What was that? There was a movie. I can't remember who was in it.
I know. It's William Macy. And I know why. You know why? My wife calls me the cooler when we go to Vegas. and there's other things, too. And this is funny. Like, it's derogatory. I mean, towards me. But she calls me the cooler. And there's a lot of situations where I realize, like, oh, God, everything turned around when I showed up. And it's true. I mean, gambling is just not my thing.
Uh-huh.
But when I show up at a table, like, it cools the table. It really does. And here's a weird little tidbit, little tiny thing of this.
Sure.
In that movie, guess what kind of car William Macy drives?
What? I haven't seen the movie.
He drives a 67 Chrysler Newport.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's blue. I haven't looked it up in a couple of years because, you know, just searching for the car and, you know, parts and things like that along the way. And also looking up the cooler to remember exactly what it was about when I've been called that many
years. You're
the
cooler.
Times. I have been the cooler in Vegas. Yeah. I literally could probably get a job as a cooler there.
Well, just so, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the cooler thing in the film is sort of the ultimate version of the bouncer. Right. The final form.
Sort of.
The bouncer.
Yeah, sure.
And the idea is like, I'm going to ease the situation down. However, Scott, it sounds like what you are being called in this context of gambling is sort of a bad luck charm.
Well, that's what he is, really. It's not so much a bouncer thing, like you said. It's more like if a table was hot, they would send the cooler down to just kind of also play the table. But I think what happened, it skews the odds is what happens really in that case. But he also, it was more like just his presence really caused the table to cool down. It wasn't a hot table anymore so that the casino was not losing money as fast as they had been, you know, moments before.
Sure.
And I think the weird thing in that story was like once he fell in love or something, then it was like he no longer was the cooler. It was like his whole attitude changed and everything. So it was a cool story. It's interesting. I like William Macy, by the way.
Oh, yeah. William Macy's good. You know what?
William H. Macy. Right?
William H. Oh, hey, get it right.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird that we're talking about this because I think the film I was thinking about for some reason was Roadhouse. Do you remember Roadhouse?
Oh, how could I forget Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking of that cooler.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So you're not the bar fight ending cooler.
No. I'm the show up and this is terrible. Show up and things kind of go down from there. Just gambling, though.
You know, I've never gambled.
Really?
I guess I've had a lottery ticket before.
Yeah. That's gambling.
Does that count?
I guess so. It's not pulling the handle on a slot or anything like that, or you know, like putting $10 down on a roulette table. But
oh,
it is
man.
Still gambling. That's a gamble. You're spending your money hoping to win more money, but you might lose it all, right?
Well, okay. Here's the thing, and this is such a derailment, but we'll get to our actual show.
We promise.
We promise. So here's the thing. Sometimes at our office here in Atlanta, one of our coworkers will pull people's money together and they'll play the lottery collectively.
Yeah, this is when it goes above 100 million or something.
Right. He has a system that is, you know, well thought out, but it can't be that great because we've never won. And, we've won a little bit of stuff. So I'll play the lottery when a bunch of my coworkers are doing it. I'll throw, you know, $5 to the cause or whatever. But to me, I'm not doing that to win. I'm not gambling. I am getting insurance, essentially, because although there's, in practical terms, there's no chance that anyone will win. But I'm paying that $5, Scott, so that if someone wins, I won't be miserable for years.
Well, you won't be the only one to show up at work on Monday, is what you're saying, right?
Are you kidding? You wouldn't show up if you won? I love this stuff. Man.
Well, you know what? I might do it. I'm not even really sure. I guess we get to do what we love, so why not?
And it would be interesting. I'd get weird with it. My hours would get weird. I'd be smug. I'd try to buy the entire company.
You would definitely tell them what you will do, right?
Right.
That's how it would work.
Exactly. Yeah. Conversations with management would change. And, and we'd make a few new things. But speaking of fantastic segues.
That's a long way to go to get here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long way to go. And we're talking about a long story today. This is something that came to us from a listener. It was a long time in the making.
And a very patient listener. And we thank him for that. This is one that we have probably mentioned on a couple of Nuts and Bolts podcasts. It's like, oh, we really got to get to that. Well, I got a note from this person just before the holidays this year in 2015. And it was a polite note, you know, and I responded again, as I always do, like, it's on the list, Pearson. Oh, the guy's name is Pearson.
Uh-huh.
Pearson H. And I said, it's on the list. And I said, you know what? I've been wanting to do this one for so long. I'm going to put it on a post-it note and I'm going to put that on my desk. And I said, I know that sounds funny, but that's actually a big step in this process. Is like, it finally moves from the big list, you know, the one that we always say, like, well, yeah, we're going to add it to our list. And we truly do have that list. I'm going to move it from that list over onto my desk, and then I'm going to start to really dig into this topic.
Right.
So I did that, and here we are today. We've got it for mm-hmm. for Pearson, and boy, Ben, I went back into my email and searched for how long Pearson had been asking for this podcast, and I found the first instance where he asked for this, and I had to go back to our previous employer, the email box that we saved when we shifted companies from one to another. So back when we were Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Way back in that file, I found something from May of 2013.
Whoa, it's a golden oldie.
That's a long time ago. So we're talking almost 3 years. Pearson has been patiently waiting for this topic. So, good for you.
Thank you that
you hung in there with us. So we appreciate it. And, here, I'll just read the note. It says, it's from Pearson in, Richmond, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I wrote you once before regarding your podcast on antique license plates. I had a Beater 1983 pickup with antique tags on it. You were nice enough to give me a pseudonym when you discussed it on the podcast. I hope we didn't do that today. Anyway, the truck is gone and has been replaced by a 1969 International Harvester Scout 800A. It's my project car and it's sucking up more time and money than I care to admit. But it's got me thinking though that International Harvester might be a cool podcast topic. He says, if that's too narrow, perhaps one of the early SUVs in general, like Scout, Land Rover, Bronco, Jeep, etc. Well, along the way, we'll talk about a few of those, too. But we're going to focus on International and I guess mostly on the Harvester Scout model. I'm sorry, the Scout model, rather. But we are going to have some tractor history and some, there's going to be some refrigeration history. There's going to be rifles mentioned, military devices, a lot of stuff. So he says there's been a lot of articles out there saying that these may be the next hot collectible. Now, this is Pearson saying this in 2013, and I invite listeners to think about this carefully because I ever since I read this, and this is one of those lines that's kind of stuck in my head because every time I go to one of the local antique car shops,
uh-huh.
Where you can buy the restored classics or whatever,
right.
I'm finding that I'm seeing a lot of Broncos and Jeep and, the old Land Rovers and
off-road
even
vehicles.
Yeah, even International Scouts. There's not a whole lot of those, but, the Harvester Scouts are around there.
Uh-huh.
More so, I'm seeing a lot of Broncos when I go, Toyota Land Cruisers, seeing just older vehicles that, he's right. It's kind of a niche market, I guess, for the collector at this mm-hmm. point, and it's definitely more popular than it was. And I've got some kind of information here along the way to back that up. I could read that now if you'd like. But
yeah.
All right. Something I found from Autoblog, and this is also going back to 2013. And I think this might be what he was mentioning. The title is Classic SUV is the Next Big Thing for Car Collectors. And what would make them think that? What would make them recognize there's going to be a trend for this? Well, Hagerty Insurance, who insures a lot of classic cars, has noticed that there was, and this is again 3 years ago, noticed that there was an uptick in not only in auction prices and things like that, but also the number of SUVs, classic SUVs, that were insured by the company. It grew up 65, it went up 65% since 2008. So between 2008 and 2013, up 65%. And that's twice the pace of the overall market. So things like Toyota Land Cruiser, there was that was the largest jump, up 202% with the number of insured vehicles in that time frame.
Wow.
Through the 1970s, 1980s, Jeep models, they went up something like 93% in that same time frame. The Ford Bronco and International Scout, they jumped up by 86 and 85%. This huge rise in popularity of SUVs in general was noticed by Hagerty early on, and Pearson caught on to it as well. And I think today's podcast will tell us, or will show us rather, that he's not far off. I mean, I've just noticed this on my own out in the field. So out in the field sounds like I'm surveying or something.
Right.
But I have noticed it around town.
So it is true. And to explore this, we are going to have to start not in 2015, not in 2016 or 2013, but more than a century ago.
Yeah, we like to start way, way back.
Way back.
That's the thing with this international brand. And like, this is going to be – it might be a little bit confusing along the way, and we'll try. But of course, there's International Harvester.
Uh-huh.
There's the International Harvester Company, which are IH and then IHC respectively. So if we read that acronym, that's what we mean. There's also a bunch of different brands in the agricultural division that we'll get to. So we're going to talk about International, Titan, Mogul, McCormick Deering, McCormick itself, Farmall, Fairway, and then another small brand called Electrol, which I think is kind of fascinating. But plus more. There's going to be more along the way. So it will get a little bit confusing. We'll try to straighten it all out. Hopefully we'll do a good job of it. So Ben,
yes.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. You started more than a century ago. So let's hear it.
Yes. Okay, so our scene begins in 1831 outside of a bar in Virginia.
It's a perfect place to start the story.
It's called Steele's Tavern. Now, listeners, I'm just going to take a gamble and say that 1831 was before our collective time. So this is the same year that the University of Alabama is founded. This is the same year that Nat Turner leads a slave rebellion. There's a lot of stuff happening. So it was easy for people to miss this guy, Cyrus Hall McCormick, and his invention, which he displays outside of this bar in Virginia, Steele's Tavern. He displays the first successful horse-drawn reaper.
Yeah, it's a mechanical reaper. Mm. And you wouldn't think that's a huge deal, but of course in 1831, it was all, you're doing this by hand at that point. Reaping the fields by hand. And it's
a very
tiresome process. It takes a long, long time to clear any sizable amount of land. And this takes care of that. This does it much, much faster.
Right. And this initial invention is amazing. People outside the bar are going, Cyrus, you're a genius. How did you ever think to invent something that works this well? And he's not done yet, Scott, because later he improves this and has a self-raking feature added.
Yeah, so that first one would cut 10 acres a day, which is as much as five men could do. So it's a significant increase in productivity, of course. And later, the self-raking feature that he adds on to it, then they can cut 40 acres a day. So this thing, it's 1831, doesn't patent it until 3 years later until 1834.
Uh-huh.
But this is really the very beginning of the International Harvester empire, I guess, really.
Yeah.
1831. And along the way, somewhere about 10 years later, around there, 10 or 12 years later, he meets up with a guy named Jerome Increase Case. And that's a weird name, isn't it? Jerome Increase Case?
Yeah. It reminds me of Increase Mather.
Yeah, you're right. It's
colonies.
A strange name.
Yeah, not as common anymore.
But that guy, Jerome Increase, he establishes the Racine Threshing Machine Works in Racine, Wisconsin. And it's a few years later when Cyrus Hall McCormick comes back again and establishes something called the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company in Chicago, Illinois. So we're up in the, I guess in the Midwest, but the northern Midwest, really.
Right. And the McCormick Harvesting Company does really well because they have a couple things going on. First, they have an amazing product in the Reaper and later inventions. Secondly, they have a very aggressive sales system. So they have a warranty that is functionally like If it breaks, just bring it back and we'll fix it for you, mm-hmm. essentially. And then they have a network of branches. They help people with credit for purchasing a machine. They're selling these things like hotcakes.
Sure. Yeah. It's a popular thing because, you know, it's such an advancement. It's like, it's hard to even put this into today's terms, I guess. Like, I can't even think of a modern invention maybe that would be similar that would, like, instantly increase productivity like that. I mean, I guess maybe going from electric typewriter to computer, maybe.
That's pretty good.
Maybe that's it. Yeah. But even bigger than that, maybe, because it was really, everything was so agricultural focused, not only in the area that he was in, but all around, not just the United States, but around the world, really, because he is marketing this worldwide, because in 1851, McCormick's Mechanical Reaper earned a gold medal at the Royal Exposition at the Crystal Palace in London, England. So, you know, he's entered the European market at this point, so he's an international guy. And Ben, we're just getting to the point where, you know, I mean, just to put it in context, I mean, we're like approaching the point where like the U.S. Civil War begins.
Right.
So that's how long ago we're talking. And this has been going on for, you know, 30 years at this point, or 25 years or whatever, you know, way back into the 1830s when Cyrus invented that Reaper. I doubt that he had in mind that he was going to be receiving gold medals in London for his invention.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, expanding internationally. Right.
Yeah. I mean, you dream big, but I don't know if he had quite, you know, dreamed quite that big at that point. It just really took off.
So from 1860 to around 1865, the Civil War in the U.S. Is as a consequence of this event, there is a tremendous expansion in mechanization mm-hmm. of agriculture. Right. So people want more reapers. They want more threshers, more mowers, and the use of that stuff expands dramatically. Jerome Case, remember? Scott mentioned him just a second ago. Jerome Increase.
Yeah, Increase. You can't forget that middle name.
That's the best part. So our buddy Increase takes on three partners in 1863. And he's got this, remember, he's got this crude thresher company out there in Wisconsin because of the availability of water.
But now he's calling his company the J.I. Case and Company. So a little bit easier to read, you know, a little bit easier off the tongue, I guess, the J.I. Case Company. And, of course, that'll be shortened to Case later on. But in 1869, the J.I. Case and Company, again, that's kind of strange to read that, I guess, the J.I. Case and Company produces the first steam engine tractor. So this is the what they call old number one,
which you can see at the Smithsonian.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's on display at the Smithsonian.
That's
now it's wheel mounted, but horses still had to kind of move this thing around. And really, the only thing it was used for was belt power. So it was driving other machines.
Right.
It's something that's you can haul it around on your property or even to a neighbor's property or whatever.
Sure.
But anything farther than that probably isn't too easy to get to. It's a massive machine.
And it took 15 years. This machine was a little bit ahead of its time, if we're being honest, because it took 15 years before steam engines boomed.
Yeah, and they're still calling it a tractor at this point, which I find interesting because it's not what we think of as a tractor by any means. This is, again, not exactly stationary, but it's not driving itself at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's all these little facts along the way. Now, we're getting towards the modern era, and I promise we're going to get to the vehicles and all that stuff, you know, the more modern stuff.
Oh, yeah,
that's the
best part.
But, man, this history is interesting because, weird to think about it, but in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire destroyed McCormick's factory in Chicago.
Yeah, it destroyed a lot of stuff in one of those buildings. Was his factory.
1871. Now, it's hard to imagine, like, you lost everything in the Chicago fire, Great Chicago fire. That just seems like it was so long ago at this point. It's amazing to think about how long this company has been around. So after that factory was destroyed, Case steps in and says, I'll build machines for you. Because remember, Case is in Racine, up in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'll offer to build machines for you, but McCormick then refuses and decides to build a larger facility in southwest Chicago called the McCormick Works.
And this place is way bigger than the old place. Mm-hmm. And also, just while we're here, I don't know about you, Scott, but I'm pretty sure that Mrs. O'Leary's cow thing is a myth.
You think so?
I think so.
Yeah? Well, I mean, have you dug into this? Do you I mean, it's just a little too clean, a little too
convenient.
You think so?
I bet our friends over at Stuff You Missed in History Class have probably done something on it.
I bet they have. You should check out that, that podcast, and maybe there's already something on this.
I will check on it and get back to everyone. So, look, the McCormick Works is pretty profitable.
Yeah, bigger and better.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger and better than ever.
And so at the same time that McCormick Works is happening, well, instead, like, what about 7 years later, 1878, Case ships its first thresher overseas, but instead of London, they go to Paris.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to go back 2 years prior to that because mm-hmm. they did something that's kind of little known, I suppose. In 1876, Case built their first self-propelled traction steam engine. And this is kind of weird. It's self-propelled, but horses are still used to steer the engine, which... all this is so strange to me. It's like, they're not putting it all together yet at this point.
Right.
And I guess that's the way these great inventions happen. It's incremental.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't understand why they didn't see it coming. You know, it seems like if you're going to create something that is self-propelled, why not make it steerable as well? But I guess horses are still needed for that.
Well, also think about the tremendous volatility of steam engines at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like just getting them to go is already...
Without exploding?
Yeah, is already tremendously impressive.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So you added a couple of years later, and you said that he was importing or exporting machines, right?
Right. Yeah, the first thresher that Case ships to Paris at the Paris Exposition, it wins first prize, and then people put it to work on French farms. But just 2 years later... All right, the guys, this is gonna be something that pops up in this show often. We're gonna talk about name changes, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so in 1880, the J.I. Case and Company, you're right, that is difficult to say, that partnership is dissolved because Case was working with three other guys at the time. And in its place arises the J.I. Case Threshing Machine Company. Seems like a little bit of a hair splitting difference, but it has implications for the business later because that year, or excuse me, 1 year after that, 1881, economic warfare begins. And I think this is so cool. This is history that a lot of people are not aware of. The Harvester Wars.
The Harvester Wars. I like it.
I know. It sounds like some kind of dark fantasy film.
So what was happening in the Harvester Wars?
All right. So in the Harvester Wars, there was a period of intense competition and bottoming prices. People were racing to the bottom to have, to sell the most with the lowest price that they could possibly still make a profit on, and sometimes even taking a loss, which is something that businesses do today. You know, sometimes a like printers, of course, are probably the best example of this. Mm-hmm. Right? You sell a printer at a loss so you can make the money back with the ink.
Oh, my gosh. That is so frustrating to me. you've hit on a hot button point for me because
I could tell.
The price of the printer is the same as the price of the ink refill.
Right.
And you can buy a brand new printer with ink in it for the same price as you can buy the refills. So mm-hmm. it's maddening.
It's a racket.
It really is maddening to me.
Yeah.
So they're racing to the bottom. Mm-hmm. This is something that's not sustainable. You have to make a profit. Otherwise, you're not going to be in business.
At the same time, they're expanding. At least McCormick is expanding. This isn't necessarily because of the horse-drawn reaper at this point. This is because they invented a twine binder.
A twine binder. Okay.
A twine binder.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of competitors
now
in that field.
When you say twine binder, that reminded me of this kind of like list of things that International has built along the way.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And there's going to be more added to this, I promise. But for, like, as far as agricultural items, they're reapers, they're tractors, commercial and consumer grade.
Right.
And then there's also balers and combines and manure spreaders and, milling machines. And you said twine, right? There's a twine baler.
Twine binder.
Twine binder, yeah, I guess. And stationary engines and, feed grinders and just, there's all kinds of agricultural items and, you can go into any, agricultural manufacturer's shop today or showroom maybe and see just a huge variety of things. And International has been doing a lot of those from the very beginning.
Yeah, in many cases, they invented the equipment.
Well, that's true. Yeah, a lot of these come from this company. They were a huge powerhouse in the agricultural world at that point.
Okay, Scott, I hate to say it, buddy, but we are spending a lot of time on tractors, and I don't want this to be one of those podcasts where you and I get to the very end and say, oh, also, there's the International Scout.
No.
That's like my favorite part
of
the show.
And we never intended to talk about tractors as long as we already have, but, you know, there's actually some fascinating stuff here.
It's just so interesting.
Yeah, what do you say we skip through the, oh, you know what? There's two things. We're going to skip through this timeline a little faster now from this point on.
Agreed.
But there was something that you mentioned just a moment ago to me that you said you absolutely wanted to cover, and that was the Jerome Case freakout.
Yes. That's my term for it. Okay, the Jerome Case freakout, really quickly. So you know how we talked about Henry Ford in past podcasts, how crazy he was,
yeah,
and how he actually tore apart one of his own cars.
Yeah, he lost his mind when they wanted to change the Model T.
Right. So Jerome Case also has some eccentricities. He will go to people's farms, make a personal visit to someone's farm if a Case thresher or steam engine is not performing, and then he will repair it himself. And this is tremendously impressive to people when he goes to this Minnesota farm and says, "I'm here. I'm like the owner of this company, but I want to repair this one machine because my name is on it." And when he can't repair it, he loses his mind. He soaks the thing with kerosene and sets it on fire and is saying, like, "I am disgusted that this ever made it out of my factory," and leaves.
What?
The next day, these befuddled farmers receive a new Case thresher. Like that, and it works perfectly.
Well, hopefully told them before he left the farm that he's going to ship another one. I mean, but holy cow,
I hope not.
He burned down their machine and
yes.
Wow, what a temper on that guy. Huh?
I know. That's what I call the Jerome Case freakout, and I just wanted to establish that.
You know how many times in this last week I've wanted to soak something with kerosene and burn it? Because I would have moments like this all the time if I could. If I could get away with it, I would.
I hear you mumbling sometimes during the meetings.
Sometimes. Sometimes I want to soak that laptop with kerosene and just walk out.
I feel you, man. Yeah. I feel you. That's why they don't let us have kerosene in the office.
Yeah, that's probably why. That's why we have that rule. That's like rule number three of this building.
Right? Yeah, no, it kerosene. Sounded weird.
Yeah,
sounded
strange, weird, but now it makes sense.
So
goes
back to 1870. Let's go forward to the future.
All right. Where do you want to go? I mean, we can step through it, I guess, because there's a few things here that are kind of standout events for me. And if we do that, we then get on to some of these more interesting to us, automobiles and things like that. Yeah, maybe that's where we go. How about that?
Deal.
Okay. All right. So, and there's some other side stories along the way that
there's
I want to tell.
Many.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Many of these. It's a good story, this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in, I think it's 1892. Case built the first gasoline tractor called the Patterson tractor. It was not successful, and they didn't build another gas tractor all the way until 1911. So they put this thing on hold from 1892 until 1911 when they thought there was a market for it. So they actually had it just kind of in the storage area.
Right.
Waiting around for that to happen. Because they're still messing around with steam at this point. They're still building steam tractors, or steam engines, rather.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then here in 1902, this is kind of a big one, and I think what we should hit on this one. In 1902, the International Harvester Company is founded from the Deering Harvester Company, Plano Manufacturing Company, the Champion Line, and Milwaukee Harvester Company on July 28th of 1902. So this is really the birth of the International Harvester Company in 1902 from all those other companies that they absorbed, I guess.
And they do it with the help of a fellow named J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan. And that's the name we still hear today, right?
Right.
It's an investing firm.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just talking about a recent movie that has J.P. Morgan in it, right?
Oh, yeah, The Big Short?
Yeah, The Big Short, yeah.
It's, the bank.
Yep.
Not the individual.
Well, yeah, that's right. at that point. But this is actually the guy. This is the founder of the company.
The eponymous.
Yeah, exactly. Morgan. So
they're integrated.
They arranged and financed this whole corporation, the very beginnings of International Harvester Company. And if we go forward again, we're just stepping through this whole list
here.
So You know, this thing is growing along the way, year by year, getting bigger and bigger. And after about 10 years, so remember we said they put that tractor kind of on the back burner?
Yeah.
In 1911, they released the first gasoline tractor called the 3060 in 1911. And then 8 years later, they came out with something called the commercial PTO, the power takeoff. It was never around until 1919, mm-hmm. and International Harvester was the first company to develop that.
And also, at this point, around 20% of their branches are outside of the U.S. They are a, what's the word, a Leviathan.
Yeah,
they're
giant.
Gigantic.
Just enormous in size. They're a huge international company. By 1923, there's a guy named Bert Benjamin, who built the first successful row crop tractor, which was called the Farmall. Now, Farmall is another brand name that we hear because it eventually became its own brand name. That was just a model at that point. So, I think they called it the Farmall Regular at that point. But it wasn't its own brand. It was just a model at that point. So later it becomes that.
Right. And the Farmall has a couple of things that put it streets ahead of other tractors. So it's got a lighter design. Its power to weight ratio is superior. It's got a narrow front with one wheel for guiding, right? Mm-hmm. And it has precision steering.
Mm-hmm.
So this agglomeration of more sophisticated qualities makes it just a better tractor design.
Yeah, early 1920s. So, you know, these things that sound old to us, I mean, it looks like an old tractor design. That's brand new to them. This is cutting edge at this point.
And I just want to say there was another war at this time, the tractor price wars.
Well, yeah, in addition to World War One.
Yeah,
we're at the time in between, I guess, right? So there's World War One, then there's the tractor wars, and then there's World War Two.
So what's next?
All right. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but that's what's going on, right? Uh-huh. So in that time between World War One and World War Two, in 1936, and this isn't a huge deal, but Harvester Red number 50 was adopted for all International Harvester tractors. Now, we've talked about race cars and, you know, how certain countries have different colors for the racing vehicles, and that signifies that. Well, kind of like John Deere with their green and yellow paint scheme, International Harvester has Harvester Red number 50. And then if you want to step way far ahead, so we're getting closer to the modern day, which I bet a lot of people are saying, thank you. In 1963, Case had 125 distributorships and subsidiaries in the United Kingdom, France, South Africa, Brazil, and Australia with 15 licensees in other countries. So again, 20% of all U.S. production is shipped overseas by 1963. So this company, that's like 130 years into the history of the company, though, at that point, in 1963. That's a long, long time, but man, have they grown. This is a huge, huge company.
It's so weird that this company could be so prolific and so widespread and often so little known.
Yeah, that's true. I found one more quick little note on the paint color, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We said it was 1936 when they had the Harvester Red. In 1983, Case had to change the color of their 94 series tractors to black and white, which was an unheard of move for them.
Weird.
Cause, you know, they had the standard color. The government regulations banned lead paint, and all red and yellow paint happened to contain lead.
Oh.
So they were unable to use their company colors on these vehicles at this point. So they had to switch over to black and white then. All right, Ben. So we're jumping all over the place in the timeline here. So, I mean, we said we wanted to speed it up. So here's what we'll do. I'm going to read just a brief bit of information here that hopefully will just kind of encapsulate this whole thing.
The summary.
Right? So again, going back to 1902, and I'm not going to go through any more history really, but in 1902, remember J.P. Morgan merged the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company and the Deering Harvester Company, along with three smaller agricultural equipment firms, to form what is known as International Harvester. In 1985, International Harvester then sold off almost all of its agricultural division to a company called Tenneco Incorporated, who then merged it into its subsidiary, which was J.I. Case. And under the Case IH brand, following this term of, you know, this agreement that International Harvester had put into place there with Tenneco, they said that the International Harvester would be the brand name, I guess, would be renamed Navistar International Corporation, and that happened in 1986.
I'm dizzy from all the names.
Well, you know, honestly, Ben, it's so confusing, and we tried to get through that tractor stuff as fast as possible, and believe me, that is the fast version of it. And I know it's hard to believe, but You know, we've got a lot of listeners that write in and want to hear about some of that agricultural stuff. And I know that, well, I know that Pearson wanted to focus on the vehicles, the International Scout vehicles. And I think we can get to that at this point, finally. Yeah, finally. There's a lot to get through and some other side stories along the way, but what, so we have to go to 1959.
Right.
Where the Scout 80 model was released. That's the first International Scout model.
Yeah, so International Harvester was building trucks and pickups and stuff. Since 1907, this is not their first rodeo.
Yes.
But they were very, very different things. So 53, they have a truck-based people carrier called the Travelall, right?
Yeah.
We talked about that.
Yep.
But the Scout itself, the idea comes in 1959. And from 1960, right? 1960 model year.
Yes, that's right.
So 1960 to 1965, they've got the original Scout 80. This is like the predecessor of many SUVs that you would see today.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Like, they didn't call it an SUV at that point, but when you see them on auctions today, like the Barrett-Jackson auctions or whatever, they'll call it an early SUV, even though it wasn't really termed that at that point. It just wasn't a known term.
They built it to be a Jeep killer.
Yes.
They built it to be competition for the very popular Jeep.
Yeah, the CJ in particular,
right,
which was the civilian version of the Willys Jeep, that it was kind of the carryover, I guess, from the military World War II Jeep that they used.
And one thing that's really cool about the Scout 80 is that originally it had a folding windshield.
Yeah,
that the windshield would fold.
Yeah, yeah, that's really cool. There's a lot of really interesting stuff about these vehicles. Now, one thing that I learned on a recent auction, I was watching a Barrett-Jackson auction, and I just had it on while I was doing something else. You know, I think a lot of people do that. And one of the vehicles to come across the line was an International Scout, and I don't recall exactly what year it was or anything. It was a copper color one. One thing that they mentioned was that it had all flat glass. Every piece of glass in the thing was flat, and that was because of manufacture. It was easy to manufacture that way. It was a very cost-effective way to do it and easy to replace and, you know, all that. So little things like that along the way will pop up here about these vehicles, but you want to hear just kind of an interesting story about the chief designer of this whole thing?
Like
how the whole thing, I guess how it all came to be, because within International, they were in International Harvester, they kind of had the idea that they were going to do this because they, again, as you said, they had been building these light duty trucks from 1907 all the way through. Well, they continued through 1975 or something like that. Very different vehicles from the Scout models, but around this time they said, well, we need something that's going to compete with the Jeep. We need something that, you know, Ford's, well, I think Ford later came out with the Bronco. It was much later, but that type of vehicle. They didn't know if it was going to sell or not because there wasn't really a market at the time for a four-wheel drive recreational vehicle. And that was that was the whole idea behind the Jeep. And they thought, well, how are we going to have our own spin on this? So the chief designer of this whole thing, the guy that was tasked with designing this whole project, I guess, out of nothing really, his name was Ted Ornas, spelled O-R-N-A-S. And he knew that this was an unknown market. You know, it was a kind of a risk at the time for them to do something like this. And the original design was very, very flat, very square, had no body contours at all. Of course, the flat glass plays into that too. But can you imagine? I mean, looking back at the Scout 80, that to me looks very square. But it was even more so than that at this point. And you know, when the higher ups, I guess, the program directors or whoever, you know, above the chief designer, looked at this, they decided, I don't know if this is really something we want to jump into. It doesn't look like a great design. They weren't thrilled with it.
Right. And they weren't sold.
And the program almost died. It almost never happened because of that original design. So Ted goes back to the drawing board, literally. I think it was like a kitchen table design that he came up with, you know, one night just kind of to save the program. He said, I got to do something because this whole thing is going to go away and I really believe in it. So literally on his kitchen table, he sketches out a brand new design that's similar to that one, but it has more contour to it. It's more detailed, I suppose. And shows it to the company execs, the top guys, and they all said, you know what, I like what you're going with this, and actually we're gonna revive this program based on this new design. So they kept it, and the new design was called. This is kind of strange. This called for in order to save costs, they were going to have Goodyear build a plastic body.
Yeah, the plastic body. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, let's talk about
it. It's so weird to me.
Yeah, and the Goodyear would do it. Now, the reason that Goodyear was chosen to do this is because they could do these massive, you know, panels that were required for this vehicle in plastic. And plastic was relatively new at the time. It was something carryover from World War II.
Right. Yeah. Goodyear was one of the only companies that had this manufacturing capability. And it was directly because they had really focused on producing plastic parts for the Allies during World War II. And they had formed a large plastic engineering group specifically for that purpose. So in 1959, you know, Goodyear is working on this model stuff and looked at their cost. Like, what's the cost of making this plastic stuff?
Yeah. Yep. And they decide, and finally, you know how it works, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they come in with an initial bid and then it creeps up a little bit more. And if you want to do that, it's going to be a little bit more expensive. And the cost, the thing kind of went away. I don't know if they came to their senses and decided that this is going to be an off-road recreational vehicle. We made it need to be a little more tough than a plastic vehicle. I don't know exactly what the deciding factor was to go away from the Goodyear product, but they decided that they were going to actually stamp this thing out in steel. It was going to be a steel body, and they went with that, even though the cost was going to be more, but maybe it had kind of leveled out a bit with the plastic body design.
Right.
It's very expensive to do something like that, and I just don't know exactly the one factor that switched their mind. But they did end up with a steel body. And so this thing went through the whole project from start to finish was really, really fast. I mean, the development time was really, really quick, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, how quick was it?
24 months, which is unbelievably impressive.
Yeah, very. And remember, 1959. Now, 24 months, that's a super fast push through. So they had a clay model by July of 1959. And I think it was approximately November of 1959 when they released this vehicle as a 1960 model year.
Yeah, and people loved it.
Yes,
this was it's difficult to really convey the popularity of this. We can talk about some of the packages they did, like the very first special package they had on the Scout 80 was the Red Carpet Series.
Oh, the Red Carpet Series. Yeah. Very nice. Very aptly named. Huh?
Oh, yeah. And it was to celebrate selling 100,000 Scout 80s.
Nice. So they're very, very popular. Mm-hmm. People obviously, you know, we said it was kind of an untested market at this point, other than that CJ, which really wasn't the exact same thing. I mean, I don't think so. It's a little different. It's not dramatically different, but it's just enough different that they were able to carve out their own, their own market, I suppose.
And they, you know, they're continually innovating. So the iconic Scout 80 by 1965, it's pretty much iconic, is replaced by the Scout 800.
Yes. Now that is, okay. There's a couple of models here. It's basically the same design. There's a few upgrades, electric wipers, newer engines, things like that.
Better heating system.
Yeah. And there's two models here actually within the 800 model year or model line, I guess. Maybe.
Yeah.
There's the 800A and the 800B. And I believe, Pearson said that he had an 800A. So that was somewhere between 1968 and 1970. Mm-hmm. The 800B was between 1970 and 1971, and then that gave way to the Scout 810 in 1971. And here's kind of an interesting note. In 1971, those Scout 810 models, and I think there was only one year that those were produced, some of those early Scout 2s, which is the next model year, which also our next vehicle, I guess, that debuted in 71, they contain Scout 810 badging in the glove box. So kind of a carryover thing that happened in production. And then later in 1971, Scout 2 came out from 1971 till 1980. And this was this one is a little bit different. This one, standard production models had removable soft or hard tops. They had a 100-inch wheelbase. Mm-hmm. Along the way, they make these small changes, but stuff that people are asking for.
Right, yeah, they're pretty responsive to their customer base. Some of the DNA from the old days of horse-drawn reapers and threshing machines still carries on. So they are listening to what their customers want, and they're continually improving. I gotta ask you, just personal opinion, out of the ones we've discussed so far,
okay,
which do you like the most?
Oh, we're through the Scout 2? I like the original. I like the Scout 80, and I also like the Scout 800s, I guess. So anything prior to 1971, I think. What about you?
I'm really interested in the International Scout 2, man, because especially, listeners who have checked out some of our earlier podcasts, You know that we're big fans aesthetically of wood paneled cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I associate that, to me, that feels very 70s, you know, and maybe that's why I keep going back to the Scout 2 as my favorite.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, that shape, I can see that, that working as a wood panel, a fake wood panel side or something.
Let me amend that. I'm sorry. I should say my favorite car to realistically drive, because that Jungle Safari trailer is probably the, you know, the white whale. For
that's
me.
The one, huh?
Oh,
that
man.
Is, that's
can you imagine?
The one. Yeah, that would be cool.
That is so impractical.
Yes, it is. All right. So, So where are we in the timeline here? I think we're just at the Scout 2, right?
Right. We're just at the Scout 2.
Well, okay. The Scout 2 was produced from 1971 to 1980, and there's only seven total models here, but there are also a number of special editions
and
that we'll
variations.
Get to. Yeah, we're on to what, like the fourth or fifth one at this point, but, within the Scout 2, line, I guess, there was also the Scout 2 Terra, which was built from 1976 to 1980.
Right.
And this was kind of like the light pickup truck version of the Scout 2.
Mm-hmm.
And had a longer wheelbase. This one was stretched another 18 inches. So it's a lot longer than the standard Scout 2 model.
Right. And it actually has a fiberglass top.
Yeah, I think the one you're talking about is the Scout 2 Traveler.
Oh yeah, well.
There's okay. The Terra and then
and
the Traveler.
Traveler,
yes.
Okay. So, they both had some form of fiberglass top.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay.
But they were different. And I think there was a hatchback, like lift gate on the Traveler.
You're right. So the Terra was the pickup truck version. The Traveler was more like the,
more like a wagon.
Yeah. Like the SUV looking version, right? And, the fiberglass hardtop that you mentioned, there was a third row of seats, which was not all that common, I guess, in that type of vehicle at that point. Cause think about what it's competing with around this time, around, you know, the mid 70s, early 80s. It's competing with the cars I've read before, the Ford Bronco, the Jeep, what's another one? The Land Rover, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
the Land Rover.
You know, those boxy SUV-esque vehicles. You can't call them SUVs even at that point, but, so that's kind of its competition. And then in 1977, between 1977 and 1979, there was another model. So again, within the Scout 2 line, it was called the Super Scout 2.
The soft top Safari 2.
Yeah, the fabric. So it also had fabric doors too, right? And a roll bar. You know, soft top as you mentioned. I think that there was also an SS version, if you want to call it that.
Right.
It stood for Super Scout instead of Super Sport in this case.
And they were, and these were really popular in off-road racing during the 70s.
Yeah, in fact, they had some national or international championships, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. On the off-road racing circuit. So it did very, very well. They were well liked by the people that did that kind of thing during that era.
So,
special packages.
Special packages. Let's talk special packages.
Yes.
All right. As you said earlier, Scott, there aren't exactly a wealth of different model lines, but there are a wealth of variations and modifications and special packages. So there's the Shawnee Scout, which is it's like a feature package, and it's produced by someone else.
Well, this is interesting because this is probably the, this is the most rare of all international scouts.
Oh, by far.
Yeah. You know how many, Ben, were produced, right?
Right. Yeah.
Three vehicles produced of this.
For you, one for me, one for Noel.
That'll work out perfect, right? Yeah, I'm sure. They're not tucked away somewhere in a museum, right? But there are only three Shawnee Scouts produced ever. Now the difference with these things was they had, you know, a lot of trim features and things like that too, right? But, mainly it was built by dressing up a black SS2. So again, that, what did we say? It was
Super Scout.
Super Scout. That's right. Super Scout 2.
Super Sport.
With special tomahawk and feather decals, special seats.
Whatever that means.
A black Targa style top, a hard tonneau, bed cover, and of course a Hurst shifter.
Right.
All right. So that's kind of cool, but it's not anything like, you know, it's not like a complete overhaul of the vehicle or anything. It's mainly an appearance package. I mean, I know there's the Hurst shifter and there's some other dress up type items, but, it's really not like, you know, this is like the only one, the V10 engine or something.
Oh, and I'm going to drop a reference here that maybe will come up later in the podcast. The Fate of Hurst Performance. Do you remember that, Scott?
The Fate of Hurst Performance.
They were eventually bought by Sunbeam Products, and Sunbeam makes small appliances.
Okay. So should we take it right now? Should we do it? Because
let's let it sit for just a little bit.
Okay.
You want to talk about some more special packages?
I do. Let's finish the special packages,
okay.
And then we'll get to, and please don't tune out at this point because there's something really fascinating going on with appliances.
Yeah.
And
it's like your favorite part.
It's a theme that has carried throughout the past 7 or 8 years with us. But, but I finally think I have a good handle on the whole thing. And maybe this is, maybe today, Ben, is the explanation that will make sense to both you and I why auto manufacturers also built home appliances.
You've been digging into this one. Yeah.
I have.
Can't wait. I was excited when you told me about this off-air.
And it goes other directions too. So there's more to it than that. So hopefully you'll hang around for that. So let's jump right back in with the Selective Edition Scout 2.
1978 to 1979. They had some gold accent stripes. This was all about gold.
Yeah.
Gold spoke wheels. Right. They had a sports steering wheel, Goodyear Tracker ATs, black grille insert. And then they had other options. You could get upgrades on the seats, the interior, cruise control, radios. You had a couple of options for your powertrain as well.
Yeah. Different colors you could get with this thing, you know, radios and stuff like that. So, again, that's a lot of appearance type upgrades.
Yeah,
you know,
it's cosmetic stuff. Yeah, except for the powertrain.
Exactly right. Yeah. So then later in the 1970s, there was the Spirit of 76 and the Patriot Special Editions. And the Spirit of 76 was, of course, the U.S. Bicentennial Edition.
Right. I thought this was cool.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. It has a special blue soft top. Blue and red side applique, which is only available on the Scout 2. Mm-hmm. And then the Spirit also had a blue interior, a racing type steering wheel, and 17-inch chrome rally wheels, rather. And I think that, you know, it's a low production number, not as low as the Shawnee Scout.
Yeah, more than three, but here's the thing. Although we know it's rare, we have no idea how many were created.
Yeah, I mean, the ballpark, though. Is right around just under 400.
Right.
That's just a guess, I suppose. And that's based on the number of line tickets that were given out for this.
Right, because some of the Patriots were built without being designated a line ticket code.
And that line ticket is really important. And you know, it sounds like kind of an inconsequential thing, but the line ticket is what designated, you know, what would go on that vehicle, how it was to be built.
Right.
And, you know, a certain code number, like 16928 indicated a deluxe interior. 16872 indicated a blue interior color. Things like that, right? So
yeah.
If you had this line ticket that had all these codes on it, that you know, they're factory codes, a code, I believe that it was attached to the underside of the hood as well on the vehicle, but you were also handed one when you bought one brand new. It was, you know, part of the sale.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one that stays with the vehicle, one that you've got kind of for your own personal records. And people covet these items because
oh, yeah.
If you've got the line ticket code for your vehicle, you can bring it right back to original based on everything that came from the factory,
mm-hmm.
everything that came from the factory. So it's very important for a collector to have something like this. It's I guess, and I don't know if it's quite as important, but think about like numbers matching cars, you know, where the chassis lines up with the,
right.
the number for the engine lines up with the number for the body codes and all that. So, it's really important for international harvester owners to have, the line ticket? Yeah, line ticket.
The line ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives not just the designation for cosmetic stuff like color codes, but also for, you know, powertrain.
Well, imagine if you had one that was like, let's say it was brown. You know, at this point, and
uh-huh.
you look back at your line ticket and you realize, wait a minute, this one had the, this applique on the side. Oh, I've got a Patriot model here that has been painted along the way.
Yeah.
It could be something that's, you know, valuable to you in that way that you could restore it back to original and it would be, authentic. It'd be real.
So, this is important and this is a way to kind of gauge the history, the original state of your vehicle, in this case, your Scout. Here's one that I think probably has my favorite name.
You think so?
It's just it's so weird, man.
It is kind of weird. You're talking about the Midas edition.
Yeah, 1977 to 1980, International Harvester gets with an outfit called Midas Van Conversion Company. And if you follow us on Twitter, which we're more than welcome to do, we are Carstuff HSW, and every follow gets us a little bit further away from being fired. As I like to say.
That's always good.
Always good. But if you check us out on Twitter, we were lucky enough to have our listener Ryan write into us, with a link to a documentary called Vannin. And it's about the van lifestyle that van enthusiasts have and their conversions and stuff.
Custom vans,
which are so cool sometimes and then just so tacky other times. But by God, man. I love them.
Yeah, there's still something really cool about Vans, isn't there?
So the Midas edition has some of this Van inspiration, the most 70s stuff you can imagine. You know, it's got the swivel bucket seats. It's got shag carpet, of course.
Of course it's got shag carpet. Of course it does. It has a color keyed interior. It has door panels and headliner and grill guards and sunroofs. Oh, dual sunroofs.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Well, you don't want to have to share a sunroof.
Well,
are you,
you know,
a peasant?
Well, you can see that. Yeah, yeah. You've seen that in custom Vans before.
Yeah,
like crazy,
totally.
You know, crazy window shapes and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So, overhead clocks and third row seating and, you know, tinted windows, fender flares, stuff like that. So, they have a lot of different models too. They had the family cruiser, or you could buy just the cruiser.
Uh-huh.
They also had the street machine and the off-road vehicle. And then, of course, there's another company that gets in on this game too, called the Van American company out of Goshen, Indiana. Now, the first one, the Midas was, Midas van conversion company was in Elkhart, Indiana.
Isn't that weird?
Well, you know, you think it's weird, but then here's a point that we didn't mention early on. We should have.
What's that?
All these international scouts were built in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's where the factory was.
We should have mentioned that.
Yeah,
earlier.
Well, I mean, you know, we've been up in the Midwest. You know,
yeah,
we were talking about
Chicago.
Wisconsin and Chicago and that area. But the international scouts were built in Fort Wayne, Indiana. So it makes sense that they would go to van manufacturers in Elkhart and in Goshen to complete these conversions. Now, I guess they did a similar type thing with the Van American vehicles, you know, similar to the, I guess, to compete with the Midas.
Right.
Versions.
But they were way less prolific.
Yes. Yeah. They're really, really rare today. So if you can find one of those, you know, outside of the Shawnee version, I guess, these were also a rare option.
Hold on to it.
Yes.
Keep it safe.
Special package, I should say, not option.
So while we're talking about specials, where more appropriate for us to go, my friend, than to one of the rarest models produced by IH, the 1980 Special Limited Edition RS Scout. Only available on the Traveler. Only in Tahitian Red.
Yeah. So this one is more, I don't know, is it the most rare? I don't know the production numbers on this.
It's one of.
Yeah, I guess so.
But I don't think anything is going to ever be... I think that the rarest would be the Shawnee Scout.
I think so. I mean,
there are only three.
Yeah, well, there's only three unless they only made two of these. I'm not sure. I don't have production numbers, but this one had things like polycast wheels with you said Tahitian red metallic accent.
Uh-huh.
That was the paint color for the body, by the way.
Yeah.
It had plush velour russet interiors. You can imagine what that was like, right?
Right.
including the headliner and visors that were also done in that velour.
Uh-huh.
Special pinstriping, wood grain trim instrument panel, and shift console. That sounds kind of nice.
That does.
Yeah,
it's classy.
Yeah, it's classy, like a van. chrome bumpers, tinted glass, had a lot of other things going with it. And then while we're in 1980 and the last year, I guess, we should talk about the two other special editions or special packages that were offered. And that was the 844 and the 434 Gold Star models.
Right. So they had the standard equipment, but they also had a 345 V8, which was nice.
Yep. Heavy duty clutch.
Heavy duty. And, the, you know, that AM radio rear seat.
AM radio. You could get an AM radio on that thing?
Welcome to the future, my friend.
Well, it was 1980, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't standard to even put FM at that point, and cassette wasn't really big by then. I mean, it was just gaining ground.
Yeah.
So it's funny when you look at that, like it was a big deal that they put an AM radio in. Sorry, I derailed you.
I think it is a big deal.
Yeah.
We take so many things for granted. I know I'm going to sound like an old person when I say this, but every time that I'm just stuck in traffic listening to the radio, I end up staring at it like this piece of alien technology. Radio is amazing.
It is pretty amazing. Yeah.
So I'm still like back in the 1980s going, radio is amazing. And, you know, maybe
an insight to your ride home.
Maybe I'm being an anachronistic person. But anyhow, it didn't just have the radio. If that was the big thing, they would have called it the radio model.
Yeah, that's right. The AM model. The Scout AM.
So,
no, they didn't call it that. These are the special packages, and they have things like side appliques and paint on the lower body, which
black
wasn't
carpet.
Around. Oh, black carpet, yeah. Big deal, right?
Right.
But they also had different rear axle ratios and things like that, too.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
it wasn't all on the surface stuff.
Right. Which, I gotta be honest with you, man, I am glad because it irritates me sometimes. Now, I don't know why it gets on my nerves so much when there is a custom package that comes out and it's entirely cosmetic.
Yeah, there's
it
a
bugs
lot.
Me.
There's a lot of that.
I know. I should just chill out and be cool about it. but it bothers me.
You know, it is, it's pretty rare when a special edition package comes out and it means like something completely different. Like you get a different engine, you get a different suspension.
Right. You get a substantive difference instead of a special color of paint.
Well, you're going to pay for that through the nose too.
Sure,
I mean, it's going to be a lot more money. So maybe that's part of it too. You know, like I can get this version for that, but you know, if I pay another 11 grand, I can get this version. That has to play into the, you know, the decision to go through with that product.
Right. And I get it. And I do admit that I like the Spirit of 76 and the Patriot. I think they're cool. I need to just be cool with people putting out special packages, even though they in no way change the performance of the vehicle.
Well, you're trying to tell me that red stitching on the seats and the steering wheel doesn't change the performance of a vehicle? Are you trying to tell me that?
We
can fight right now.
We can fight right now.
We can.
Noel, we're going to go outside and fight. Oh, no. Okay. No, we're kidding. We're kidding.
He says it's not a good idea.
No, we're good.
Get out of the studio because there's expensive stuff in there.
Boy, Noel Refrigerator Brown had a look of surprise.
He's like a bouncer in there.
He's the cooler.
All right. So, you know, the cooler. Okay.
There we go.
Well, we're back to it because I promised that we would talk about this and I don't know. This is one of the more interesting angles of this whole thing. And I know it's not as cool as, you know, talking about the vehicles themselves, because those are really fascinating. And you know what? There's a whole history with the light trucks that we probably could cover in its own podcast still.
That's true.
We really just grazed over that from 1907 to what, 1975, I think, with the light pickups.
Oh, wait. Before we get into the appliance thing, though.
Yeah, sure.
I want to give listeners some background. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your first episode of Car Stuff. Thanks so much for dropping by. You are about to hear what I hope is a solution to a problem that has bewildered my co-host and I for 6 years?
Yeah, 6 or 7,
six
I think.
6 or 7
at least
years.
As long as we've been talking about it.
6 or 7 years. We've been trying to figure out, and our longtime listeners, you guys know this as well, we've been trying to figure out why there is a strange and surprisingly common relationship between vehicles and small appliances.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a common link.
Yeah.
It seems like there's so many automotive manufacturers that also create things like, you know, mixers or
toasters.
Refrigerators
yeah.
or, yeah, toasters and things like that. It's so strange, isn't it?
It's weird.
It's really weird. So I think I may have the answer here, and this is the best version of this that I've found so far to date anyways, but at least the best explanation. So International Harvester, here's a little bit of trivia that you may not know, Ben. This kind of led me to this whole thing. On the series Friends, I never watched Friends.
Okay.
On the series Friends, I don't even know who these characters are, but there's a character called Chandler and Monica.
Okay.
See how out of touch I am? I don't know who they are. They had an apartment, I guess, and in the background, in those apartment scenes, you'll see a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
The refrigerator is an International Harvester refrigerator, which is relatively rare because they only made them for a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you about that in just a minute, but I think that's just kind of like a little bit of pop culture mixed into it. And that kind of led me to this whole thing because International Harvester also made home appliances. And of course, they're best known for their farm equipment, you know, stuff like that, you know, the agricultural stuff.
Right.
And then later, you know, the light trucks and then the scout models and, you know, the off-road vehicles and all that. But, it was a household name really and on farms all across America. Well, really all around the world, as we said, for a long, long time prior to, you know, them building automobiles at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a common thing for International Harvester to be known among farmers. And then they thought, well, how are we going to get ourselves out of the fields and into the home?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a weird thought, isn't it? But how are we going to get those farmers' wives to know about this as well? And I don't mean to sound sexist at all, but this is exactly who they were targeting with this. They were targeting the farmers' wives with this, knowing that the farmers would say, that's a quality product. I'll support that purchase or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, trying not to sound sexist, but I'm going to do my best. So International Harvester develops along the way a refrigeration equipment, division, I guess.
Yeah.
And they built things like refrigerators, air conditioners, freezers, you know, like walk-in freezers, big meat freezers and things like that for, you know, for, let's
venison.
Say you have, well, yeah, I mean, you're on your farm, you're creating your own food and you're canning stuff and, you know, all that. So, maybe that's a bad example. Canning stuff, you put it in the cellar, but, they've got their own meat or whatever. So along the way and around the same time, you know, we're talking like, just prior to World War II, maybe right around that era.
Yeah.
other auto manufacturers teamed up with other companies that also had refrigeration units. So Ford teamed up with Philco. Chrysler had this division called Air Temp. General Motors had Frigidaire. The Nash Kelvinator Corporation, and then later American Motors, had Kelvinator. Studebaker had the Franklin Appliance Company, and Crosley had its own Crosley-named or Crosley-branded refrigeration unit. So these refrigeration divisions are key to this whole thing. If they didn't build refrigerators or freezers or air conditioners or whatever, that wouldn't happen. And when you think about it, okay, the refrigeration unit is important because they use a smaller version of that in their cars when they make air conditioning systems.
Yeah, that's
so that
point.
So that's important. So they said, well, you know, why not merge these two? We can make money, you know, doing all kinds of stuff like that. That sort of matches up like that. Well, the International Harvester Appliance Division was originally developed to manufacture these commercial grade items to farmers, and a lot of these farmers had just then received electricity on the farms that they worked on. So imagine this, Ben. It's like World War II, and this happened on my grandfather's farm. I talked to him about this several times in the past.
Uh-huh.
They didn't get, he lived in Monticello, Indiana, right near, Indiana Beach on Lake, I think it's Lake Schaefer. And they had this kind of out of the way farmhouse. It was out in the middle of nowhere, big family, but they didn't get, electricity until after World War II. Can you imagine?
That's crazy.
He lived on that farm he lived there for like 30 years. He came back after the war, went back to the farm, and that's when they got electricity. So all these farmers are just now getting, you know, electrified, I guess, and, you know, all across the United States. And, of course, they wanted things like milk coolers and these walk-in freezers, you know, for the produce and meat that we just talked about. And International Harvester, as I said before, they were trying to kind of court the farmers' wives in a way that, you know, made it attractive to them. This appliance would be attractive to them. So they had, and this is very clever, Ben, this leads to another whole discussion here, but they had a spokeswoman for these products, and her name was Irma Harding. Now, Irma Harding was not real.
What?
Yeah, not real. It's not a real person. Now, there's versions of this. I mean, I'll get to it. I'll explain it in a way that'll make sense. But it's actually Irma Harding is a factory trademark for the international brand. It's not really a person. It's sort of like Betty Crocker was. Betty Crocker is not a real person. Betty Crocker is an idea, I think.
I see.
And there are people that played Betty Crocker, and there's people that played Irma Harding.
Like the Marlboro Man.
Now, see, Irma Harding, that's very clever. IH. You know, Irma Harding.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, exactly. Like the Marlboro Man. There are a lot of people that played the Marlboro Man, but the Marlboro Man is more of an idea to sell a product.
Right.
And that's exactly what Irma Harding was for International Harvester. It all makes sense. So they had this huge, campaign where they had, lots of really nice print ads, and you can find some of these, and they're very well done, but they have the refrigerator front and center.
Yeah.
And then they have ways that this, Irma Harding character, who is drawn on these, on these advertisements, a way to customize these appliances for your kitchen. So you can add fabric to the front of the thing. You can add, handles that have different colors. They might have 10 different colors that can coordinate with other things in your kitchen. So they're really playing into this, and they call it, I'm trying to get this name right. It's like feminine engineering, but it's, femineering. That's
femineering.
It. Femineering. That's it. Yeah. Femineering. So this is one of the first examples of femineering products.
Weird.
And this is so strange. Now, the person that created this, now, Irma, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here. Maybe I need to say this. These were two women within the company headquarters that were kind of, the inspiration for this character, this Irma Harding character. One's name was Zelma Purchase, and the other one's name was Olive White, but they aren't the ones that are portrayed there. That's kind of like their persona, but the image or the face that was used for the artist prints for these ads was a model named Ann Farr, spelled P-F-A-R-R. And the artist, his name is Hayden Sundblom. And Hayden Sundblom is somebody that you all know, but you don't really know who he is. I mean, he's the guy that is also responsible for Aunt Jemima, that character.
Uh-huh.
He's also responsible for the Coca-Cola Santa Claus character. He's also responsible for the Quaker Oats Man and lots of pinup models. He did a lot of pinup designs. So I don't know. And he also did, the Sprite Boy. I don't know if you've ever seen the Sprite Boy for Coca-Cola. It's another ad campaign.
Guy.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. He's he was a Finnish illustrator, out of Finland. And, it's fascinating to me how they took this, this idea that we're going to have, this Irma Harding, with the IH initials, that they're going to sell our International Harvester freezers or refrigerators to the farmers' wives. And this era, I mean, it played right into the era perfect with the Coca-Cola Santa Claus character and the Betty Crocker character, and all that stuff has a really interesting, interlaced history to it. I mean, they all relate in some way or another to each other. It's just a fascinating time in history.
And it is weird. It does make sense from a manufacturing standpoint, but this feminineering move, which is really interesting. I want to see what our coworkers, Kristen and Caroline, think of it.
Yeah.
On Stuff Mom Never Told You. When you look at it, what a status symbol it must have been to have this refrigerator. And the marketing was so well done because there are recipes that require a refrigerator.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. And people today seek out these International Harvester refrigerators. It's just like anything else. And I know we're running late, but can I take just one moment to mention something that I don't know if I ever have?
Oh, please.
When I first moved here to Atlanta, I know that people seek out these appliances the way that some people seek out classic automobiles.
And that's true.
I ran across one of these cats when I first moved here to Atlanta. I was selling a washer and dryer set that looked like it came from the 1950s. I don't even remember when it was, but they were in perfect shape, condition. I've got photos of them that I can show you later, but they're classic 1950 type design, right? I put them online on Craigslist or something like that. The guy that called me was very excited about coming out to see them, right? I had lots of photos, and he came out, and he was super jacked about seeing these things, right? So not only did I show him this, and he was very excited. He wanted them immediately as soon as he saw them. He knew exactly what he wanted. He also wanted to see the washer and dryer that I was replacing those with. And I showed it to him. You know, I thought, well, okay, I'll show him.
Yeah.
And this guy was so excited. He's like, oh my God, aren't basket washers so cool? I love this thing. You know, he's like, tell me about these features in this thing. And he was talking with the enthusiasm of somebody that was there to, look at a classic vehicle. You know, that's the only thing I can compare it to because that's the way, you know, you and I think, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to go into someone's garage and then you were to see next to it something also exciting, you would probably talk about that a little bit. But his enthusiasm, his excitement for appliances, in particular, washers and dryers. He had this encyclopedic knowledge of these things. It was unbelievable. He gave me so many little facts and tidbits about the set that we were looking at right then, the one I was selling him.
Yeah.
I almost wanted to keep them by the time he had left. You know,
it was contagious.
Well, yeah. I helped him carry them out, and we were very careful about it. And he apparently he had many of these in storage that he was just hanging on to. I don't know what he would do with them. But it was just a really interesting character. And so I know that appliances like this, like the International Harvester refrigerators and other devices that you'd find around the farm, I suppose, or other appliances, are just highly sought after collector's items at this point. And some people are just hungry to get these things in their collection.
Hey, maybe this guy's like a Scrooge McDuck or something. Instead of a vault of gold coins, he just has a bunch of basket washers.
Well, who knows? In 20 years from now or something, maybe these things might be worth quite a bit of money. I don't
That's
know.
True.
Maybe they are now. Maybe I was taken, because he sure made them sound like they were, worth their weight in gold, really.
Well, if he's saying that, then maybe you weren't being swindled. Because if he was really trying to swindle you, he would be like, he'd have a bit more of a poker face.
I think it was a fair deal. A fair deal was struck in the end. But honestly, this whole international thing, I would love to talk about international, just their light pickup trucks.
Yeah.
From 1907 through the 70s. Fascinating history. The company, I hope we didn't get too long about the tractors, but I think it was necessary to build a case for just how long this company's been around and the rich history that they have and why they're such an important name.
They
and
make
still,
so much stuff.
Yeah, lots of stuff. We didn't even talk about rifles. We didn't talk about other military aspects. There's all kinds of things.
We didn't talk about some of my favorite vehicles, like the Travelall, which is just a great and weird looking thing.
You tried. I might have steered us the wrong way. Sorry about that.
No. We had to do it because we could just spend, that ultimately I have this weird dream of living in a car, and we got this great letter from Rudy Smith, a longtime friend of the show, and Rudy rightfully pointed out, Ben, you might just like the idea of living in a car because the RV lifestyle, based on what you're saying, is not what you want.
Yeah, the reality is far different.
So I recognize that I'm somewhat romanticizing this or being naive about it, so we don't need to enable – enable my weird dreams of running away and living in a Travelall or a Unimog or whatever. But man, they're fascinating. Please Google them.
You know, Rudy, I think he mentioned in that note that he and his family often would travel in a bus, I believe, a converted bus.
Yeah.
And he had a terrible
terrible
disdain for campgrounds.
Yes.
And the type of people you meet there. Well, some, I guess. Not all. So, anyways, we'll dive into that maybe in another episode. But Pearson, thank you so much for sending this in. And I really, truly apologize for it taking so long for us to get back to it. But man, what a history. This is another really good one. And it doesn't have, you know, like the sordid past, like U-Haul or, you know, the William Shakespeare company, you know, the fishing company.
Or the Dale car.
Yeah, the Dale or anything like that. But it is a fascinating past. And I hope we've even touched on just some of it. There's way more there than we were able to get to.
Oh, and Irma Harding was brought back in 2014.
Really? I didn't know that.
As a branding on some, I saw the design brought back for, some plates. Or something like that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So, all right. So maybe like some Franklin Mint plates or something.
Something like that. Yeah. We'll check it out. We'll be on the case. We hope you enjoyed this show.
On the case. I just got it.
Oh, I didn't even mean that.
The J.I. case.
On the J.I. case. There we go, Scott. And we'll continue to provide updates as more information or even just strange historical tidbits about J.I. Case and Company and International Harvester come out, or as we discover them during our weird internet rabbit holes.
Yes, Navistar or whatever they're called now.
Right, yeah, whatever their name is this week or this year.
It seems like it.
So in the meantime, if you want to check out some of the other stuff we referenced in this podcast, go back to our older catalog. We have a bunch of stuff. We're closer to 1,000 now.
We're zeroing in.
500. Yeah, we're at 700 something.
I think we're getting close to 800.
Wow.
Well, maybe. I don't know. It seems like it's growing a little slower at this point because we're only once a week now.
Right. Yeah.
But, so it's growing a little bit slower, but we're way up there. I mean, it's so many that, you know, we have listeners that write in and say, I've only got 343 more to go, but I'd like to comment on this this high-speed stuff episode about whatever it was.
We should, you know what, we should do some sort of celebratory thing for you ladies and gentlemen who listened to all of the episodes. So I'll be honest, in our early days, there were a couple stinkers. They're my fault, but there are a couple stinkers.
No, don't take all the blame. It's they're tough to listen to, but we were learning the craft.
They're tough to listen to.
Not that we're pros now, right?
Well, here's the tip. All right, so you can listen to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, what have you. But iTunes, as you have said before, Scott, will only let you listen to the first 300 or so.
Yeah, the most recent 300.
Most recent 300. If you want to listen to all of them, you can go to our website, carstuffshow.com, and that's where you can see every single episode that we've ever done, including, of course, the ones we're mentioning these tidbits. You can see some awesome stuff that Scott is posting on Facebook. You can check out the documentary for Vannon, which I do recommend. And thanks again, Ryan, for sending that on our Twitter. We are CarStuffHSW at both of those. And if you, like Pearson, have an idea for an upcoming topic, we may not respond on time, but we do read everything.
Well, I hope we won't make you wait 3 years. But but if you do want to contact us, you can reach us at carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.